Margaret, I am Vicki, and I am a recovered alcoholic. Thank you for asking me to come share at the meeting. It's a privilege, more than anything, I think, to be somewhere, asked to be somewhere. You know, my life is so different today than it was 14 years ago. I'm one of these kind of alcoholics. I believe I was supposed to, I should be dead. That's what I believe. I also believe today there is a God, and that's why I'm not. my sobriety date is January 28th of 1992. I'll just tell you that so you know I have one, remind myself I have one. And that's by the grace of God. And I belong to a home group, Harbor City Speakers Group. It's the best meeting I've ever been to. Some people will tell you I've heard it said, and I stole it from many people, that I hope you think that your home group is the best group you've been to, and if it's not, you can stay there and try to make it better. Don't come try to fix ours. It's doing well on its own, just the way it is. And I like when people say that because, you know, that happens. And I have a sponsor who I get with regularly, and I utilize my sponsor. I still today, hopefully for the rest of my life, will believe that that is necessary in my recovery. Although God is the answer for my sobriety. And I try to sponsor other people. You know, I try to carry the message. I don't do it well. Sometimes I'm not good at it at all. I started out in the beginning trying to carry the message of Alcoholics Anonymous by pounding it into people. Today I've gotten to the place where I pretty much can sit back and wait. And it's taken 14 years of practice and 14 years of learning experience and guidance from sponsors and literature and things to help me to become a little more godlike. And in the beginning, my first sponsor shared with me that I needed to become God-reliant instead of self-reliant. And it's taken a long time for me to begin to do that, you know, the practice to get to do that. So I'm here to tell you a little bit about what I was like, what happened, and what I'm like today. I'm glad I don't have to tell you something I read or something I've studied because I'm not good at that at all, and I sound like a babbling idiot. And sometimes even when I'm telling my story, I sound like a babbling idiot because I get in there. But I'm just here to share with you my experience, what has happened in my life, what I was like, what happened to me and for me, how I got to Alcoholics Anonymous, and what my life's like today. And I even get a little uncomfortable when I say my, because I truly believe in my heart that that my life belongs to God. I really do. I believe that, like I said in the beginning, that if I was in charge of it and it belonged to me and I made it and I was my own maker, I wouldn't be here. I really truly believe that because I set out on a mission to take me out. I spent quite a few years trying to do that, and that's how I ended up in AA. As I said, my sobriety date is January 28th of 92, and I've had three sponsors since then. I just wanted to get that up front because sometimes I forget to tell that. And I was born and raised in South Baltimore in Maryland. Raised in an alcoholic home. I couldn't wait till I was old enough to get a drink. When I was a kid, there was nothing in the city for kids to do that I knew of. And we had five kids in the family, and I couldn't wait till I was old enough to get in one of those bars. You know, I would sit on the corner behind, they'd prop the bar doors open. There was a bar on every corner and just about in the middle of every block when I was a little kid. They'd put them in city row homes, wherever they could stick one. They'd stick a bar, and that's all there was to do. And I remember sitting in the summertime out next to the bars on the corner, and they'd prop the door open, and the smoke would pour out of there, and the people would laugh, and they'd have music real loud, and people would dance, even during the day. And it just seemed like there was a whole lot of fun going on in there, and there wasn't a whole lot of fun going on in my household. My dad was the alcoholic. And so I couldn't wait to get there. And when there was any laughter in my home or basically, wherever I saw fun, people were drinking. Whatever else they were doing, I wasn't paying attention to, but they were drinking. And I couldn't wait till I could get there and do that. And I was attracted to that. So I was about 14 when I had my first drink. I was in a back alley, big alley with some kids, three or four other kids. We had a bottle of Boone's Farm wine, and we were passing it around. And I can't tell you today, I don't remember getting drunk or feeling anything from it. I didn't get sick. What I do remember about that was that as that bottle was going around, I don't know how many times it went around, it came to me with maybe two, three drinks left in it, and I started to think immediately that this wasn't coming back. And the excitement of just having this bottle in my hand, I guess I realized that. So I finished the bottle off. And little did I know that every time I drank after that, I was going to do that. I was going to finish off whatever I could get a hold of. I didn't know that, but I was only 14 years old. And I didn't get drunk, I didn't get sick or anything, and I did not pursue alcohol from that point on, because I hadn't yet really got the effect of it. I was somewhere around, sometime during 15 years old, I believe I got the effects of alcohol. And when I was, you know, my dad had this idea that he had five kids, and when you were 18, you had to leave. You know, his legal job was over, and you had to go. It didn't matter if you were, if you finished school, or if you were married, or if you were having a kid, or, you know, if you were ready or not. It didn't matter. When you were 18, you had to get out. So, you know, at 15, I met this guy who was working at a market, Cross Street Market in downtown Baltimore, and his parents owned a luncheon stand, lunch meat stand down there, and he was like 17, I was 15, we met, we started going out, and long story short, we went, he took me to a lot of places where there was a lot of alcohol, and he lived across town in the upper side of town. I was from the downer, so, you know, it was different sides of the tracks here, and he come from a little bit of money. My dad was a drunken fireman, and so we were like from different families. His mom was a Christian, and he just went to church regularly, and she, you know, they were wonderful people, awesome people, and but he was a bad teenager, and he took me to a lot of places, introduced me to a lot of stuff. We went to a lot of people's homes. We had those car parties and stuff that kids have in the basement, you know, drinking parties. You got to drink a shot of beer if you lose a game of cards or something like that. And of course, I didn't mind losing because I loved drinking, and it was around that time that I got the effect of alcohol. See, I was always a very quiet, very shy, backward kid, totally opposite today, but I was, and I was always full of fear, and I just had that awkward look to me. We were very poor, and I was always embarrassed, ashamed, you know, and like I said, I had a lot of fear, and when I had that alcohol in me, sometime during that time in the beginning of dating this guy, I got taller, and I got prettier, I got bigger boobs, you know, I was just cuter, and I just stood up. It was like I stood up, and I know I've heard so many people say that, but I have to tell you, that's what happened. You know, I just felt better about me. I was able to laugh and talk with these people, whereas in this basement party, I would sit in a chair against the wall, you know, give me three, four drinks, and I'm up, and I'm in the middle of it, and I'm sitting on the end of their little bar, and I'm playing the card games, you know, and I'm having a blast, and half of it I wouldn't remember. You know, I started out, I think, having blackout drinking, and in the beginning it was short-term blackout, and in the end it was my longest blackout, I think it was like 2 years. I have a two-year lapse somewhere in the middle, and you'll see that when I stand here and look at you like, well, where am I? And I'll move on about 2 years, because, you know, I probably don't want to know what happened in those 2 years. I mean, apparently what I know and have remembered about my past has kept me here 14 years, so I can have the rest. I'm not looking for it. So anyway, he and I were, you know, I was coming up on 18, and he was a kid. He was a partier. He was a real partier. And, of course, I went along with him. And at this time, it was more like the party and stuff, you know, the weekend drinking. And, you know, I was just a kid having fun drinking. I loved it. I loved it. I never questioned it. I never questioned how much I drank or if anything was wrong with it. It seemed normal to me. My father did it. My mother did it twice a year. You know, all the neighbors did it. Everybody in South Baltimore did it. It seemed like that's what you do. That's a part of everyday life. So I never questioned it. And so I was coming up on 18, and I convinced him that he wanted to get married, so we did. And I had to be out by 18. And, you know, I have to tell you at this point, I look back today and I realize that I was really very confused. I had no idea what I was supposed to do in life. You know, at 15, I went to cosmetology school. As soon as I turned 16, I got a cosmetology license, and I was working as a hairdresser, making a few bucks, not much at all, very few bucks. And he and I, you know, we got married, and we lived together a couple of years. Now, I had a little girl by him. She was 6 months old. When I asked him to leave, due to his drinking. I was around 20. Due to his drinking and other things he was doing. He liked that marijuana stuff and everything. Of course, I did too, but, you know, it was him. And I figure, you know, when I was a kid, I saw a lot of things. I thought my idea of what women were supposed to do in life, what men were supposed to do in life, was kind of like my idea. I had to figure it out. So what I saw became my idea. And I believed, you know, that men were supposed to get a job, hopefully, bring home a paycheck. And women were supposed to raise a man, raise kids, and take care of a home and be home all the time. And that's what I believed. So I set out to do that. He got in the way of that. He wanted to still party. You know, he had a dartboard hung up in the middle of the living room. He had cake parties in the tub. Now here comes this little baby, you know. And he got in the way of me being responsible. Now, when I was raised in South Baltimore, I saw a lot of women and a lot of people, especially the women I paid attention to. They would go, you know, they had 3, 4, 5, 7 kids at home, be on welfare or whatever, and they'd go to get all dressed up, go to the bar maybe on a Thursday or a Friday, and, you know, I'd sit on my front steps. I mean, we had 4 bars I could see visually from my front steps. And they'd go in one bar and come out with a guy on their arm, go in another bar and come out with a different guy on their arm. They'd be gone 3 or 4 days and leave all those kids, you know, and I said, I'm not going to do that. And, of course, we had a pretty rough childhood, being raised in an alcoholic home. It was real rough. And I always said I wasn't going to do that. I wasn't going to be like my father. If I had children, I was going to treat them right. As a matter of fact, I didn't want to have any children because I felt so sad for children, you know, that didn't have good parents. And we had a lot of that going on in our neighborhood. So I was going to adopt kids, and I ended up pregnant. So anyway, I was never going to be like those people. I was going to do something with my life. I was going to be somebody. I was going to get out of South Baltimore, and I was always ashamed of being raised in South Baltimore. I was going to never told anybody where I was from if ever I got out of town, you know. And I never told them about my family and, you know, who I was or anything. I had a lot of shame that came from my ideas. I had no reason to have shame. And so I never wanted to be like that, and I ended up, you know, I asked my husband to leave due to his drinking and everything because he got in the way of me trying to be responsible, trying to be a mother. You know, what I thought being a mother was, what I thought was being responsible, you know. And so he left, and I moved back into the city with, actually, I ended up going through another so-called relationship. I never know what to call those. They're not quite relationships. They're just pickups, you know what I mean? Like, you pick them up, and they always got to be worse off than me, you know, because that always made me feel better, that they needed me, and I could help them, and I was smarter than they were, and whatever. It's just, I have a little bit of Al-Anon in me, too, I think, which I think is pretty normal. I guess it is. I don't need to evaluate that. I'm okay with it the way it is. But anyway, I asked him to leave, and he left. I got into another relationship, or so-called. He was married and was living at my house and with his wife. I didn't know it. I didn't know it. I just wanted what I wanted. Anyway, I moved back in with my dad when that was over with, back in the city. And I was around 20. I think I was 21, but I still can't remember. I was such a blackout person. I mean, even when I didn't drink, I think I was having blackouts. And I still today can't remember things very well. I was about 21 years old, and I remember I'm working, I'm taking care of my daughter, I'm raising, you know, taking care of my dad, and I'm taking care of the house. My mom had moved out one more time. It was one of those times, and I'm trying to do all the right things. I'm trying to be responsible. My daughter's spotless, you know, she's going to nurse, you know, she's being taken well care of, and, you know, everything's taken care of, but I didn't feel right. I felt like something was missing. Now, 21's very young. I think at 21, you know, we're ready to roll. And I didn't know I had disease of alcoholism. I think a normal 21-year-old, like, needs to get out there, you know, just wants to go. Well, I wanted to go, and I didn't know where or how, because I was a very shy, backward kid. I never had a lot of friends. I never really ventured out into anything. I never got into trouble. I was the only one in the family, as a matter of fact, that never got into trouble. Went to school all the time. All my brothers and sisters were always getting caught hooking school and always in trouble down at the railroad tracks. My brothers were always getting locked up. I was the only one never got into trouble. It's amazing. I mean, it's amazing. And so, Nancy, I forgot where I was. Oh, yeah, I was living with my dad, and I thought something was missing in my life. I just felt like, you know, okay, I'm being responsible, I'm doing all this stuff, but I'm bored, I'm no fun, what's going on? So anyway, met this lady who lived around the corner, and at that time I thought she was an older woman. She was around 32, and that's young today, and very young, and because I'm still young now, and she said, well, why don't we go out, you know, on the weekend or something? And, you know, I said, sure, you know, why not? I'd never really been out. I'd been to the little corner dumpy bars and the little country bars and the in-house games and parties and stuff like that. I'd never really been out to a club or anything. I was very shy. I just never really ventured out from my home base. And she said, let's go out on the weekend. So it was a Friday or Saturday night, and I'm in my dad's house in the city row home. They're like matchboxes. You know, the rooms are like, it's like five rooms, the whole house is a little place. And I'm upstairs, and I'm, you know, running back and forth for about 2 hours it took me to get ready. And mind you, this is in the early 80s. It's like 82. And some of you are too young to know the 80s, but some of you aren't. And I remember in these 2 hours, I remember everything had to be perfect. See, my hair, I had this big hair, and I don't have a lot of it, so it takes a lot to make my hair big. So I had big hair, and I had all this makeup. And of course, I could put makeup on, so I had tons of that on. And I had these 7-inch high heels, like huge high heels, this little mini skirt. I was a little tiny thing then. And 2 hours it took me to get ready. She didn't say where we were going or anything, but I remember feeling so excited when she knocked on the door and I walked across the floor. My knees actually got weak. I was so excited. I didn't know where I was going. I was so ready for this, but I didn't know what I was ready for. And I walked to the door, and I'm thinking, you know, wherever we're going, it's not here in the city. We got to be, somebody's going to take us and drop us off somewhere. We're getting a cab or something. Well, we didn't. We went, and being out of town, you guys won't get this, but we went about 2.5 blocks, walked about 2.5 blocks from my dad's house to a place called the Copacabana. It was another corner bar. But it was about twice the size, maybe three times the size as the regular little dirty country bar. And it was a step up. It was more disco and 80s music and stuff like that. And I loved to dance. I always did. Ever since I could walk, I loved to dance. And so I remember walking up to the door. And mind you, I'd never been in this place. Didn't even know it existed. And I was raised right around the corner. And I remember opening the door, and the smoke poured out, and the music was real loud, and the people were laughing and dancing, and I was just like, wow, why didn't somebody tell me about this place? I was raised right around the corner, and I just felt like, oh, my God, this is it. I just knew when I went in the door, and they had the big glass ball in the middle, like two of them, and they had a big dance floor and a DJ. Oh, man, it was awesome here. I'm 22 years old, and I'd never really done anything like this, okay? So that tells you a whole lot. And I go in there, and of course, I'm dressed to the hilt. I'm 80s head to toe, okay? I'm ready because I saw this on TV and everything. And we go in there, and they had this big square bar. It was close to almost the size of this room. Maybe a third less. But anyway, I walk around the bar with this girl, and we sit on the other side because the dance floor is over there, and we're right next to the DJ. And I remember sitting at that bar, and I'm looking around because I don't know how to act. I don't know who, you know, what I'm supposed to be. And I'm sitting there, and I start to fold my legs and I try to act like a young lady, and I didn't really know what that was. I had no clue. I'd never really been taught anything. And I'm sitting there, and she's ordering a drink, and she says, I forget what she called it, but anyway, I didn't know what to order because all I'd had to that point was vodka and orange juice, rum and coke, and beer, you know, and so she ordered something, and I thought I'll have what she's having, so I think I was on my second pink drink when I turn around and look behind me across on the other side of the bar, around the other side of the bar, and there he was. There was this guy. Oh, he was gorgeous. I mean, he was about 2 inches taller than me. He was a little stocky, just a little bit of muscle, which was nice. And he had, his hair was perfect, which was very important in them days. It was the wings down the middle. His hair was perfect. These beautiful, piercing blue eyes. These gorgeous blue eyes, and our eyes met. Of course, I had all this makeup, so my eyes looked real good for me. You know, so our eyes met. And Next thing you know, I'm sitting there, I'm having a good old time. I'm only on my second pink drink, you know, I'm still pretty straight. But I loved the music and the laughter and the colors of the walls. I loved everything in there, boy. And he comes walking around the bar, and he walks up to me, and leans on the bar like this, and leans over to me, and he's whispering in my ear, and he's telling me these things like I've never heard before. And, you know, and I'm melting off the chair, and we fell in love that night. We won a dance contest. We moved in together about 2 weeks, 3 weeks later, you know, and, dear, I'm not even divorced yet. I'm just really just barely separated, and we move in together, and we were just in love, okay? This was the main relationship that I ever had, the longest term, the really in love, infatuated kind of relationship. Sick. Very sick. Anyway, when we were living together, during the course of the 4 years we were together, I found out, and I knew he had one child, but he had three other children by two previous women that he was never married to. I had my daughter. I ended up with five children in the course of that relationship. He took me out of the hair salon. He said he didn't want me to work there because I was working for some guy, and he was very jealous. He just came in one day and grabbed my arm and took me out. He said, "You're not working here anymore." I thought that was wonderful. I really did. And thank God for the third step today, because that's crazy. Pure insanity. I just thought he was awesome. And he was a construction worker. He did drywall finishing, acoustical ceiling, stuff like that. He was really good at it. And I don't know, because by this time I'm drinking pretty good. And at this time with this guy, I started doing other things besides drinking that I don't talk about in Alcoholics Anonymous, out of respect for AA. But, you know, take your own inventory. Most of you probably have done the same things I've done, and I did quite a bit of it. However, I came to at some point, I don't know, I couldn't tell you, it was 2 weeks, 2 months. I don't know, after he took me off that hairstylist job. I came to holding a scaffolding in my hand on a construction site. I had work boots on and big brown work boots. I had a nail belt, I think, around me. And I'm standing there holding a scaffolding, and I come to. And I'm looking around. It's pretty quiet. It's a big building, and there's somebody up on the scaffolding. And I'm standing there, and I'm thinking, oh, my God, is this a job? Do I have a job here? Honest to God, I did still to this day don't remember that. And I'm thinking, well, you know, too. You know, you've come out of blackout, some of you, I'm sure. And I'm thinking, well, I can't ask somebody what I'm supposed to be doing here. Like, I just came out of a blackout. Could you let me know if I'm supposed to be working? What am I supposed to be doing here? And so the boss's son, whom I didn't know at the time, came over and gave me a spackling can and a knife, a 6-inch knife. He said, come on over here. I'm going to teach you how to do these nail holes, point up nail holes. And I'm like, okay. And so we go and we do these nail holes, and he says, so I start doing them, you know, and I'm working along. I didn't know I was, I was clueless. I was such a blackout drinker. And so I ended up doing drywall for about 4 years, 3 years into that. I think it was 3.5 years into that relationship, and about a half a year to a year after he and I separated or whatever. And I got really good at it. I became a really good drywall finisher. And I could hang drywall, and I could do the acoustical ceilings. I had stilts. I had walk the bucket. I could walk a bucket like boom, boom, boom. I was a little tiny thing then. They used to put me up in the rafters to do the firewalls and stuff up there, because I could slap the mud. Instead of putting the guys up there, they gave me my own. I had a tool bag for finishing, and I had the tool belt and the screw guns and another bag for drywall hanging. I had the acoustical ceiling stuff. They gave me a van. You know, I did that for about 4 years. I made good money doing that job. I also hurt myself. I physically think I pay for that to some degree today. I have a lot of therapy. I get on my shoulders, and I've had both elbows operated on and one wrist. But I got really good at it, and I worked really hard at it. And I tell you that because, you know, in taking my inventory, I realized today that, you know, and I've heard it said many times in AA that, you know, we either feel less than or better than, and I'm not saying this to be different, but I just still today cannot remember ever feeling better than somebody else. I always felt less than. I always felt less than. And so working at this company doing this drywall was working with all these men. And, of course, I didn't want them thinking I was sleeping with the boss to make the money I was making. I might have been sleeping with the boss, but I didn't want them thinking I was sleeping with the boss. I really didn't. So I had to work my butt off to, you know, just to prove to them that I was able to do the work. And so, yes, I got muscles up in my neck and under my arm. Like, men have muscles. I could take a 62-pound bucket of spackle and throw over my shoulder and pick up another one and walk like a man. I mean, I really had to prove myself. That's all the good it got me, you know. But I just always felt less than. I always had to work a lot harder, I felt, and feel today, looking back, that I always had to work harder than other people just to be equal, just to try to get equal with people. That's how I always seemed to do things. And so anyway, at one point he started getting caught doing things that we were doing together, really. He was doing a lot of it. And he got caught and went to jail and got back out. And then he tried to choke me because I wanted to leave. And I was selling furniture in the house and making loans to keep him out of jail. And he choked me up against the wall, and I called my sister. I have one sister. She's older than I am. She's the fighter. I'm not the fighter. I ain't never been the fighter. Don't like fighting. Never did. And she comes. She had this little beige Dodge truck. I think it was a Dodge truck, a little teeny thing. And she lived like, I don't know what, 10 miles, Brooklyn is 10 miles from Baltimore, about 10 miles from where I was living. And I called her up and said, "You tried to choke me, you won't let me leave." She jumped in her truck, come over there. And she always got me out of trouble. And she jumped out of that little Dodge truck, barely stopped the thing going down the road with a baseball bat in her hand. And she chased him down the street. And I didn't have no more trouble out of him after that. I mean, I had three brothers, but I called her. She was always good at getting me out of trouble. She used to fight the boys off for my brothers. You know, when my brothers would get beat up or something, she used to go out and beat the boys up. She's not a big girl. She's just a mean girl. Like your sister, Darlene. So anyway, I got away from him, and I continued to get into other so-called relationships, picking up people, you know, to try to make me feel better. And a lot of the time that I was drinking between my first husband and the time I got to Alcoholics Anonymous, I was on my own a lot. You know, I raised my daughter pretty much, I don't know, it seemed like about maybe 10 years on my own. No, it had to be about 8 years pretty much on my own without being involved with anybody for any length of time, you know, one night stands, weekend things, whatever. But I never, and I tried to raise her on my own. I didn't do a good job. I was a terrible mother. The longer I'm sober, the more I realize how lousy a mother I was. You know, I knew it was bad. I knew it was bad, but the reality of it is you can't be a mother if you're an alcoholic and you're actively drinking. I was trying to, there's the 2 years right there. It always happens. It just throws me off. So anyway, I got to where I'm living there at the house, and by this time my dad had passed away from lung cancer, alcoholism I call it, and my mom was living there back in the house, and I'm living with her. My daughter's with her father. She came to me one day and asked if she could go live with her dad. I was in a rehab at one point, and I got out of there and stayed at a halfway house for about 3 months. And I told them that I didn't like the way they were running that halfway house. And I had graduated there and left. And, of course, within an hour, I had a pint in my hand. I was drinking again. And thank God I was. I really thank God that he loved me enough to let me go and do what I needed to do. Because when I drank that first pint, I would have blown my brains out if I'd had a gun instead of that pint. I know I would have. Alcohol was my solution, and I can only see that today. I thought it was the problem, but I can see today without that, I couldn't be here today. I couldn't live with myself, you know, and alcohol kept me sane enough, really, to get here, to stay alive long enough to get to Alcoholics Anonymous. So anyway, after I drank that pint is when that was after the rehab and the halfway house and all that. I became pretty much, again, unemployable, you know, antisocial, doing nothing to do with anybody. I had nowhere to live. I ended up on the street. I started coming in places with people I'd never seen before, not knowing what I had done, what it was all about. And, you know, I'm not proud of my past. I don't want to repeat it, but, you know, I don't feel no pain from it anymore as a result of the 12 steps of Alcoholics Anonymous. That's an awesome gift to me. You know, I thought I had to carry that the rest of my life. I thought I was just going to not drink. And know, you're going to help me not drink. And I was going to tough it out for however long I had to do it. And I'm here to tell you tonight I was wrong. Thank God I was wrong. We don't have to do that. I can tell you the whole story about what I was like, and I feel very little from it today. You know, I don't feel good about it. I don't feel bad about it. It's just a story today because I'm not the same person anymore, you know. Towards the end, I had met this kid. He was almost, I think, 20, 21. I was almost 30. I was in the depths of my alcoholism. I was all swelled up and drinking constantly every day. I did find liquor about midway, maybe 25 years old. Once I found liquor, I never drank beer. I have to say that I was not a wussy drinker. I did not waste my time, and this is just my opinion of myself. I did not waste my time on beer. Once I found liquor, don't even bother with wine. That's like drinking water. And don't mix my drinks, and I don't need a chaser. I need to feel it going down so I know just how much it's going to help when it comes back up. And that's just the way I drank. I'm an effect drinker. Once I got the effect of alcohol, I drank solely for effect. And I never liked the taste of most of it. Now, that old-timers come up to me after a meeting and say, you can't be an alcoholic if you didn't like the taste. I said, I sure do drink a lot. Sure did drink a lot of that stuff for not liking the taste. I don't think it has a whole lot to do with how much I drank or anything. I drank for effect. It worked for me. It worked for a long time. Why would I keep drinking if it didn't work? It worked. It did for me what nothing else could. A man could only last a very short time. 2 weeks and I'm like, you know, moving on. New car, a week. You know, it's just moving on. None of it ever lasted. Money, the kid, nothing could hold me still. Nothing could fill that hole inside of me. Nothing could make me feel right about me. But alcohol worked pretty good for a long time. And so anyway, this kid, we got married on Christmas Eve. I had my daughter there. She was like 9 years old. His parents loved me. His mother said she thought it would be wonderful to have a daughter-in-law like me. And that just tells me there are sick people out there other than alcoholics. I mean, I was at the bottom of the pit at that time. I don't know what she saw. But anyway, I started busting up furniture and stuff. This is towards the very end of my drinking. I got very violent. I started busting up furniture coming out of Black House saying who destroyed my kitchen, you know, those kinds of things, going after my young husband. Poor kid didn't have a clue what he was getting into. He just didn't. And I came to one day on the couch in this apartment we had, and he wasn't there, and I went next door and knocked on the door and asked the girl if she had seen Harry, and she said, honey, he left you 3 days ago, I think she said, and I didn't know it. I go back in and start digging in the couch and under the couch and under the carpet and the drawers in the bedroom looking for change so I can walk that mile to that liquor store to get my half a pint, whatever I had the change for. And this was towards the end of my drinking. And I ended up moving in with my sister down off Mountain Road and lived with her for a very short time. And the rule was you don't drink. And, of course, I have to tell you, many times in my drinking, especially during the last 3 to 5 years, I had the requirement for membership. When I went into that rehab, I begged and pleaded for help. I did not want to drink. I knew I was dying. I knew that I had lost control over the choice to drink. I knew that, and I always ended up back doing it. And when I went and lived with my sister, I was like, yeah, I can do this. If I go to some meetings, you know, and I'll be all right. I don't want to drink. I won't drink. I got to get myself together. And it wasn't even 2 weeks. I mean, I didn't stop drinking for 2 weeks, but it wasn't even 2 weeks before she knew I was drinking. And I was going to some meetings, and I was in such rough physical shape I could hardly walk. And if I'd have stopped drinking, I probably would have died. I was drinking so heavily by this time. I was drinking 2 or 3 fifths a day at that time, and straight out of the bottle. I didn't care who saw me anymore. I carried a pint with me. I was trying to hold a job at a Pizza Hut, living at my sister's, and I would have a pint in the back of the toilet and a pint in the file cabinet and then a half a pint or so in my purse, and I had to have it with me at all times. You know, I just had to know it was there, and I just remember this in bits and pieces. And at some point, that trying to hold a job at that Pizza Hut, I burned my foot, and I ended up in a burn unit. I thought to be there like a week or two. I was like 3 or 4 years sober before I found out I was there 6 weeks. They were going to take my foot off because it had got infected. Anyway, I moved in with this girl who lived, who worked for the Pizza Hut. She drove a car, and they made me a shift manager. Can you believe that is so? That's what I mean. We're not the only sick people in the world. I mean, I was in horrible shape. I had to reek. And so I moved in with her. She lived with her, lived in her aunt and uncle's house, big, beautiful home on the water, big split foyer, and it was a gorgeous place, fireplaces. I had a room. I had two small beds in it. These people had never met me. She called and asked if her friend could come stay there. They didn't live there all the time. It was like a second home. And for like $25 a week, I told them I'd pay them $25 a week because I got on disability with my foot. And I could stay there. And I kept that room. And I remember all I had in there was, by this time, from the rehab and the halfway house, when I walked out of the halfway house, I had two little grocery bags of clothes. That's all I had to my name. I didn't even have a clock radio or anything. Nothing. Not a watch. Nothing. And up for another year, I had accumulated a green trash bag of clothes. And that's it. This is what I had. And I was in this room, and I had this box, a cardboard box sitting there. And it had little two pieces of, I used it like a hamper. Like it was going to be a hamper set through right next to the bed, and I kept my fists down in there. And I would always keep two fists at a time because we lived a little, like a good 2 mile walk, and I wasn't walking very well by this time. And I had, I don't know, I was sitting at the living room table, the coffee table, when I had it, the last fifth, and apparently was having a hard time getting out to get more. And I had a couple drinks in that fifth, and I'm sitting there looking at that fifth, and I realized I couldn't live that way anymore, that I couldn't take it anymore. And I believed I had done everything I possibly could to try to fix me. You know, AA meetings and rehab and halfway house. I've been to psychiatrists and therapists, been married, divorced a couple times. By this time, I had a kid, I had homes, I had money, I had a hair salon at one time, and none of it worked. None of it lasted. What's wrong with me? And I was carrying these papers from the nut house. I'd been in a straitjacket in the nut house and believed maybe I was just too nuts to get any help. And I really truly believed I was just hopeless. I was hopeless. There was no ideas coming. I had no ideas left. And so it was to either continue drinking the way I was drinking. I knew that I would die from it. My dad bled out from alcoholism, and I was already bleeding in places you're not supposed to bleed in. I was totally shut off from the outside world. So it was to either continue doing that, not knowing how long it was going to take, or to take my life. And I know today that it's only by the grace of God that I'm here, because I made a decision to take my life. And that's why I say it's not my life. Because I found out on January 28th of 1992, if you can't die if God doesn't want you to. And that's the only reason I'm here. I really truly believe that in my heart. I wanted out. And I meant it. I wasn't playing. And I ended up, I picked up the phone. It was in seconds, I think. A minute. Picked up the phone. Dialed a number. I didn't dial that phone. I know that God did that for me. I called a member of Alcoholics Anonymous, and I'd never met this person before. It was a man. Somebody apparently had given me the number, and I called this member of Alcoholics Anonymous, and he asked me some questions. I don't remember them all. Some of them he told me later, but he asked me if I wanted to go to an AA meeting, and I said, I don't know. I'd been there. It didn't work, and he asked me where I lived, and I didn't know. And he told me to get some mail from around the house somewhere, to go in the trash or whatever and find some mail and find an address of where I was living. And I did that, and he found me. He came in and picked me up. And I was, I don't know, you know, it's bits and pieces, very much blacked out. But I remember I did try to get cleaned up and get ready. I didn't know what was going to happen, but I tried to get ready. He didn't say we were going to a meeting or anything, just somebody was coming. And I got a bath, I believe, and got cleaned up. I might have even washed my hair, I don't know. But I remember going around the house drinking every drop of alcohol in any kind of bottle of any sort and finishing off it. It didn't matter what it was. I just drank it. And I had a green trash bag from the week prior of bottles sitting in the kitchen. And he rang the doorbell, I believe, and it was like this split foyer, six steps up or so, and I'm standing at the top of the steps. I believe I was on crutches. He says I wasn't, but I may not have been. But my foot was still wrapped up from the burn, and I'm standing at the top of these steps, and he's down in the foyer, and it's dark, and it's quiet, and everybody's around. We're out in the woods, and I didn't see his face or anything. I didn't know who it was, and he said, "Are you ready?" And I put my head down and walked out the door with him, and he said, as I walked by him, he said, "You're ready." And that was my first step in Alcoholics Anonymous. That was the very first step. That very moment, powerlessness. If I have anything in my whole life to be grateful for, it's the desperation I had that night. It changed my entire life. And I had this, you know, idea of God before I got to Alcoholics Anonymous, that he was a punishing God, and that's just the way God was. That's what I believed. I had no religious background. I did try going to some church, even got confirmed Catholic drunk. But I don't know anything about no religion. I don't know nothing about no religion. I really don't. I'm not down in it. I can't. I don't know nothing about it. It's just what it is. But I had developed this own idea, my own idea of God. And I believed that, you know, God was way out there somewhere. And that you have to suffer an awful lot in this lifetime to possibly, when you die, be able to get somewhere near God in heaven. And so I tried to suffer. You know, I believed if I gave enough, if I suffered enough, and if I hurt enough in this lifetime, I would earn a right to be in heaven with God. And that guy had this little zapper. You ever see those, like a fairy wand? It was kind of like that. It's my imagination of God. And when I did something, like come to with somebody I'd never met before, that, you know, we just ain't supposed to do that stuff. You wake up and there's that zapper, and the pain would come. Now I know it's the four horsemen. But the pain would come, the guilt, the remorse, the shame. Ugh. And I had to drink. I had to drink. And so I believed, you know, that God punished me. And I believed I deserved it. I never really was mad at God for punishing me. I believed I deserved it. And that was my idea of God. And when I got in that car that night, and we were riding down Mountain Road, and he was taking me to a meeting, and I was sitting in that seat, and all I could do was sob. All I could do was sob. I was beaten. I was whipped. I had nothing to say. I didn't even look at this man. And he was talking about this power greater than himself, the 12 steps of Alcoholics Anonymous, and sponsorship. He had 9 years sober. He wasn't wearing a fancy suit and didn't have hardly any money in his pocket. He was becoming permanently disabled, had lost a home, and was driving an old ratty car. And I heard this man talk about those three things, and he gave all the credit for his recovery to those three things. I'd heard AA like I'd never heard it before. You know, it was like, I'm sure it was said, but I never heard it. And I knew that I was sitting next to somebody who knew what I felt and had been where I was and wasn't there anymore, and it had nothing to do with the outside. Now, I couldn't have put that in words that night. Only in hindsight could I tell you what I felt that night, and that's what I saw. And I hadn't even lifted my head, but that's what I heard from this man. And I came to believe that night that maybe this power greater than himself would do for me what he had done for him. That very night before we even got to the first meeting. I believed that maybe I was wrong about this God. That if God loved him enough to do these things for him and to help him to stay sober, and he was comfortable in his own skin. And that's something I'd never experienced my whole life. Ever had a memory of that. And if God would do that for him, then maybe I was wrong about God. Maybe he'd do it for me. And that was the second step for me. So the first two steps were in place. And just by me getting in that car that night, I turned my will and my life over to care of whatever would have it. And if that man was going to tell me what to do, I was going to do it. And when we got to that first meeting, he pointed to a chair, and I sat in that chair. And I sat on my hands because I shook and I stunk. And I was about 25, 30 pounds heavier than I am today, and I reeked with alcohol. I sweat like a pig, and I had a foul mouth, and I'd become everything I swore I wasn't going to be. And then I found out I couldn't die, and there was nowhere else to go. And that's how I got to Alcoholics Anonymous. And I sat in that chair, and it was a step group, and they gave out chips. As if I didn't hear anything happen in the meeting. But at the end of that meeting, they gave out chips, and I got up. And I picked up a 30-day chip that night. I don't know that I heard anything except for that they were giving out chips. And I tell you that because I realized today that when you find out you can't die and there's nowhere else to go, you'll do what's put in front of you. There's nothing left. And so I got up and got a chip. It didn't matter which one. I had developed already, from the time I got in that car to the time I got to that meeting, enough willingness to go to any lengths without concern of what's going to happen to me anymore. What you think of me, what anything's about, it just didn't matter anymore. So there was nowhere else to go when I got a chip. So the man took it back and got me a one-day chip. So that's the moral of that story. The point being, willingness was the key for me. I mean, without the desperation, that willingness wasn't going to happen. You see, I can't say I'm a very intelligent person. I can say I'm not a stupid person. I believed I was able to handle my own life and make something of my life and take care of my life. And I come to find out since I've been in AA that of myself I'm nothing. I can't do this alone. I don't believe that anyone in the world can. I don't believe we're designed to do that. We need God. It's natural. We're naturally connected. And when I try to avoid that, I get very uncomfortable. I used to hear when I first got to Alcoholics Anonymous that we're human beings having spiritual experiences, and that's why we're so uncomfortable. My experience today, and has been for some time after 14 years, that I'm a spiritual being having human experiences, and that's why I'm so uncomfortable when I'm angry, when I hurt someone. And that makes a lot more sense to me, you know. And so this man became my sponsor. I didn't ask him. He didn't ask me. I'm going to buy my watch. I didn't ask him. He didn't ask me. We never discussed it. He tried to get these other women, three or four other women, to take me off his hands, and they were just, I don't know why. I was too out there to know. I don't even want to investigate. It don't matter to me. It's not my business. He became my sponsor. He's started taking me to meetings every day. He came, picked me up every day, call up and say, I'll be there at 7. Click, hang up the phone. I'd be ready at 7. I didn't know where I was going or what was going to happen, but there was nowhere else to go. And so he started taking me to a lot of meetings. We went to 2 or 3 meetings a day, 140-some meetings in the first 3 months. He was disabled and I was disabled, unemployable, whatever. You know, I was disabled too. We were both disabled. So he went to a lot of meetings and he talked. He talked all the way through the meeting, talked all the way from the meeting. Sit at his kitchen table and talk. He'd get the book out and he'd read some of the book and he'd talk. I had nothing to say. I had nothing left. I was very fortunate that way. By the third day of my sobriety, I was sitting at his kitchen table and the pain came. I call it the pain of the past. I was sitting at that kitchen table and I was just full to hear of pain. I couldn't have described it. I couldn't have explained what it was. He tried to get me to write it on paper. 3 days, I could barely talk, let alone think, and have it come out the same way I was thinking it. And so I couldn't write it. And so he took the paper and pencil, and he wrote it as I verbally did, a fourth and fourth step right there. And since then, I've done 2 other fourth and fifth steps, just like they are in the book, and that's usually how I take it. My girls that I sponsor is through the book. Rarely does somebody come here as sick and as ready as I was. It's rare. Not that I'm different. It's just rare. You know, a lot of times we get here already sober, and I wasn't. I'm a real alcoholic, like they talk about in the book. And so he wrote, and I don't remember everything we talked about. I do know that we pointed out the fears. We saw that in there. And my life was truly based on fear, as the book talks about. I had fear long before I picked up a drink. I just ran on it. You know, it was something that drove me. Fear. It was just fear in everything. Fear of not getting something. Fear of losing something that's not mine. Just constant fear of not being enough. You know, just fear. And, so anyway, we stood at the kitchen sink. This also not in the book. It's not even a suggestion. You don't have to do it. You don't have to do it for anybody else. It's just what was done for me. And I like to tell people about it because it was another big changing point in my life. We stood at the kitchen sink, and he, apparently his sponsor and so forth, their sponsor, did it for them. Stood at the kitchen sink, and he set those papers on fire. And I turned and looked at him, and I watched those papers burn, and I looked at him, and it's like I stepped out of one person and walked away another. I never felt that same degree of resentment, anger, fear, especially self-pity. I'll never forget the self-pity I had. The world had wronged me. God had wronged me. I was always, It was, I was always hurt all the time, just pain constantly in my life, and I just had so much self-pity. I don't know about other women or men, I don't know, but I had a lot of, guilt and a lot of fear, a lot of remorse, and I left her in that sink. And my life began when I did that fourth and fifth step. A whole new life, you know, just started over. Everything started over, and I was able to learn and grow. And in my first couple of years, I never pursued a job. I didn't, you know, I had a little job at a Pizza Hut, and then I went to a McDonald's, which is actually a step down, you know. And I had owned my own hair salon, but I was not concerned. See, I had had those things. I was convinced in my heart and soul that they didn't work. I never pursued a man or a car or my kid back or any of that. I had had all that too many times to know none of it worked. I went to AA. That's what I did. I followed my sponsor. I did what my sponsor told me to do. I read the books my sponsor told me to read. I stayed away from the people in AA my sponsor told me to stay away from that weren't here for recovery. And I listened to the people that my sponsor told me to listen up to. You know, and I just was so sick and so desperate, so willing to do whatever it took. I didn't want to live like that anymore. I did everything I was told to do, and I still do that with my sponsors. You know, I was given enough desperation. I was allowed to get enough desperation that I've been able to follow directions from my sponsors. You know, and to me, when they say do this or do that or go there, I hear it as you do this or you're going to die. That's because my life depends on this. My life depends on God, my relationship with God. You know, without that, I'm dead. I don't know about anybody else, but I know in my heart it was proven to me of myself. I'm nothing. I'm not in charge. I don't even belong to me. I'm not even a choice. You know, my life belongs to God. You know, I'm just given some gifts to use and to pass on and to share my God with other people. And so we did that fourth and fifth step, and thank God for the sixth and seventh step because... I had my fourth and fifth step wasn't pretty. I don't know how yours was, but it was like my guts were on the table. It wasn't nice, and it was a horrible thing. And who I had become, you know, the places I had been, the people that hurt, and my capabilities. And thank God for the sixth and seventh step. I was entirely ready, and I didn't have to understand it. The book doesn't tell me I have to understand it. I just have to do it. And I went in the bedroom and got on my knees. My sponsor said, read the seven-step prayer, and I read the seven-step prayer. And it might have been only for seconds. It might have been for minutes. I don't know, but I remember saying, God, just take it all. Just take it all, because I didn't know of any good. I certainly didn't have any write down, that's for sure, and I couldn't find anybody. I just asked God, please just take it all. And at this point in my life, I'm begging God, just do it. Just do it. And for seconds, I don't know how long, but I felt, and let me try to put this into words, I felt like God had relieved me of everything, that I was just a shell and yet full of something. And that's the only way I can explain it. I got chills standing here telling you. I felt the presence of God. And what I had become was removed. And I still get that today. When I'm willing, I'm in conscious contact, when I'm out of me, which is more and more the longer I'm sober, because I got spoiled, man. I got spoiled. When I first got sober and I got that third step and I was able to get in that car and shut up and sit down in that meeting and follow directions, I started getting high as a kite right away. Right away, and I wanted more. See, I was a selfish, piggish drunk. I wanted as much as I could get, and I would drink it until I was out, and as soon as I woke up, I would look for that bottle. And I would drink yours and theirs, and I would steal, and I would do whatever I had to do to get it. And I'm just like that in Alcoholics Anonymous. Only I want more of what God in Alcoholics Anonymous has in store for me. I want more of what God wants for me. And I don't have to steal it. I can borrow it. You know, I can take it along with me. A lot of things I tell you about my experience has been given to me, has been shared with me through other people's experience. And so that seventh step, man, don't skimp on it. Just because it's short in the book. Man, that was an awesome experience. And by the end of the first week, my sponsor had me doing the eighth and ninth step. So that tells you you can stay here 14 years and do it pretty quickly. And that doesn't mean you have to rush, but if you're ready, I don't hold anybody off from the steps unless, you know, there's really good reason. Most of the time, it's like, you want to do a fourth or fifth step, get busy. You know, it might take us another 3 months to get you to get it done, but you can get started on it. I don't hold people back. I know that I read the literature and the history, and I know that Bob and Bill, you know, they have to, you know, they say you have to be convinced. In the book, it says we have to be convinced you're alcoholic. So you can go ahead and write. Don't show it to nobody, but go ahead and write, and we'll just keep, you know, doing what we're doing here. And it'll come eventually. But at the end of that week, we were doing the eighth and ninth step. And at the end of the week, we were out in his car doing the ninth step amends. And I was serious about me amends. And I loved amends. I didn't know I was going to love amends. I thought, oh, my Lord. You know, what's going to happen now? But see, by then, I had already got a good taste of these steps. I didn't know I was doing the steps, people. I knew I was doing something. We were taking actions. We were doing something. Every day, we were doing something. But I didn't know what it was, and I couldn't have told you about it. Oh, we're going to do the six and seven stuff today. You know, I just didn't know. He'd just say, do this, do that. Let's go here. Come on, get in the car, you know, and I just did. And we started those amends at the end of the week. The only one that took a while was the amends with my sister, which took about 2 years, and I had to remain willing. That's what my sponsor said. All you have to do is remain willing, and the time will come. And we had a very violent relationship. She was the violence. And I was scared of her in that way. The last fight we had, we both just fought. We both lost hair. We both had black eyes. And it was because of my drinking. And she had thrown me out because the rule was you don't drink. And she swore she'd never speak to me again, that I would never change. She told my family she wanted nothing to do with me. In the beginning of my recovery, I went to a couple family functions. Honest to God, she walked by me like I was here. You know, didn't want anything to do with me. Told my sponsor. My sponsor called her about my driver's license, see if I had left it there. Of course, it was revoked. But she wouldn't tell him nothing. She said, nope, and whatever, hung up the phone. So about 2 years into recovery, you know, it was the only amends I had to really put off because she wasn't ready, and it would have caused her harm. She would have fought with me. You know, I had to wait. And I went to her house, and I had to go in, and I knocked on the door. You know, it's a new house. I'd never been there before. And she opens the door and walks in the kitchen. That means come in, you know. So I go in the kitchen and we're standing at the counter. Mind you, this is the first and only time I was really nervous or had fear about doing these steps. I've been fortunate, but I had some fear with this one. And I'm standing next to her and she's standing next to me. And I said to her what my sponsor had told me the last 2 years every time I was going somewhere near her to say, you know, this is how you do it. You know, I can't change the past. Because we had a lot of past. If I can't change the past, but if I keep doing what I'm doing, I won't ever have to be that person again. And if you need me, call me. And I meant that. I was supposed to mean it. That's what I was told. And I gave her a card with my number on it. And our lives haven't been the same since. You know, we come from alcoholism. And, you know, none of us are close in my family. None of us. And we're about as close as I imagine we could get, probably, with being raised in an alcoholic home and my destruction and her being affected by alcoholism. She's not an alcoholic, but she's certainly affected. I think she's beginning to know that. But we had a really rough life. And now we have, to some degree, you know, a sister relationship, which I never thought would happen. I bought a trailer down in Delaware for a weekend thing in the summers and took her down there, her and her husband, one weekend. Next thing you know, they're out buying a trailer, put it right across from mine. I got to look at her every weekend, you know. But she's not there anymore, but she stayed, I don't know what, 3 years or something like that. And we got along pretty good, you know, like sisters, we had our ups and downs, but there's been a connection there that was never there before. She knows I love her, and I know she loves me, and there was no love in my family. See, we never did no hugging, no touching, no kissing, no. We never had anything nice to say to each other or about each other in my home, ever, when I was a kid. So it's taken me even this long to practice doing that, being nice to people, and taking compliments from other people. It's been very difficult for me, very difficult. It's very uncomfortable for me to do that. And I have very loving people in my life, sponsors and friends and all, and people I sponsor. So anyway, I had a lot more amends. I got to tell you, I made an amends to three cash amends, I called. I owed like, I think it was $1,800, which was a lot. I worked for $550 in a McDonald's, okay? I had room and board to pay, and I had to buy underwear, you know. I didn't buy a lot of stuff. I saved all my money to do these amends because, like I said, I wanted more. My sponsor, my first sponsor is here to tell you tonight, I saved every penny. He said, save a large amount and then call them up and tell them you want to make restitution. That's what I did. And they said, well, how much you have? I had like $600. They said, send it in. We'll write it off. So that's what I had to pay of that amend, $600. And the next two went basically the same way. In my first 2 years of sobriety, I was such a blackout drinker that I had worked, I don't know, two or three places. I had George got somebody in the program to file my taxes for me. Of course, I can't afford to go get my taxes done for the last 3 or 4 years of my drinking. And come to find out, the state caught up with me and figured out where I was living, found, you know, got the information, started, and sent me a check in the mail for places I worked that they owed me taxes for that I didn't remember working at. And two or three places, and same thing with a little bit after that, federal government found me, sent me a check. Then a bank calls me up and says, what do you want us to do with this account? I'm like, what account? An account down in Baltimore City. I didn't know I had. I was a real blackout drinker. And you know, if I wasn't blacking out, I would have went to that bank. They had no time in there. They had nothing in there. I didn't even know I had an account there. But anyway, you know, thank God for the 10th step, because like I keep telling you, I just wanted more. I wanted more. I knew I couldn't go back. And something in me has always known I can't stand still. Something in me's known that I can't just sit here. I know a lot of people do it, but I can't just sit on one of these chairs and go to my little meeting and go home. I got to be involved. My relationship with God has to grow. It has to continue to grow. The only thing that blocks me off from God is me. It's the only thing. You can't do it. It's me. 10th step helps me so much with that. And the 11th step is what keeps me connected. And for me, there's no wrong way to do the 11th step. I've used what's in the book. I still do sometimes. I've had my second sponsor, Liz. She's a God person, and she is just all into all types of meditation and all sorts of stuff. She's taking me places, showing me things. The book tells us whatever you got to do. You know, this is to develop that relationship with God. That's what we do. So that's what I do. Whatever I got to do, you know, whatever shows up, I'm like, okay, cool, let's try this. You know, and I'm not afraid to try anything when it comes to this. I believe there's no wrong way to get close to God. No wrong way. If you want to sit on a mountaintop and chant, more power to you. Me, I could do it throughout the course of a 24-hour day, anywhere I am, anytime, any place. I don't have to get on my knees all the time. I don't have to light candles. I don't have to go to church. I don't have to do anything. But know that God and I are one. That God is with me everywhere I go. Everywhere I go. And that's the result of 11 steps in sponsorship. And now my second sponsor, Liz, is my sponsor today also. Tom was my sponsor for a while, which taught me a lot of action on keeping busy, you know, going places and doing things and staying active in Alcoholics Anonymous. And now Liz is my sponsor again, and which she always has been. And I've never really left my sponsors. I just have gone on to get some from this one and to get some from that one. I mean, isn't that what we do when we drink? There's so much available here. Nothing's put in stone to me. You know, and I don't have to change sponsors to go get help from this one or go talk to that. I don't have to do that. This is just who I'm talking with now. You know what I'm saying? And sometimes sponsors will become unavailable. Whatever. I just move on. My life's between me and God today. You know, and you know, all my life I tried to figure out what was the point. I thought that, you know, like I said, women were supposed to take care of the man and the kids and to have a job, and then guys were supposed to have a job. Boy, that's such mediocre stuff compared to what our lives are really about. I mean, I have learned today that, you know, God has given me a gift. He has given me an awesome gift. I can help somebody when no one else can, where no one else can. You know, I mean, this is a gift of life. This is true life. I mean, I was hopeless when I got here. You know, and today I am full of hope. I know there is always hope. You know, nothing's ever been able to bring me down far enough to even make me consider a drink. Not with what I've found here. They call it the great reality deep within. I have found that here. You see, God and I are together. I feel that within me. I live life. I have a husband. I have a home. I have a job. I mean, I have a hair salon that, you know, I get the key to the door. I have cars and money, dough, I have friends. I got all this stuff. But God is in the center. And I was told as long as I keep God in the center of my life, I can go anywhere in this world with anybody and do anything as an alcoholic as long as God is in the center. You know, my favorite page in the big book is page 25. It talks about how we have found much of heaven. I don't have to die and go nowhere. We have found much of heaven and been rocketed into a fourth dimension of existence, of which I could not even have dreamed. And a rocket trip is straight up. This is not an airplane thing. It's not something where you come down and land once in a while. This is a rocket trip. This is straight up. And it can be that way. All we have to do is let go. All I had to do is surrender. Surrender, man. Throw in the towel. For this alcohol, it took a lot of desperation. It took a lot of pounding. You know, and God loved me enough to let that happen. He stepped back. I have a 25-year-old daughter. I don't know, and I love her more than anybody in this world. I don't know that I would be able to step back and watch her go through what I had to go through, even though I knew and know in my heart she has to do that in order to get here. But God can, and God does. He does. He loves me that much. And, you know, I've never fallen anywhere. God's always been there to catch me. I have turned my will and my life over the care of God. He takes care of me, gives me simple tasks on a regular basis, and nothing I cannot do. Nothing. It's always simple. It's always easy. So what do? I go come to a place like this. I go out and try to carry the message. You don't have to like me. You don't have to believe me. You can say, oh, my God, she's all about God. Whatever. I don't care anymore. It doesn't matter. I have found the great reality deep within. I live a life beyond my wildest dreams right here. Not out there. Because that's all the same stuff. It's all stuff in here. And what I have found in here cannot be taken from me. I could lose the car. They could take the job. The husband can go, whatever. But what's in here, no one can take away from me. And all I have done is uncover it through the process of the 12 steps. Thanks for letting me share.